were tuned into Pentimental with hosts John and Tom McGuire. Pentimental is a dialogue-based show that elucidates the intersections between synchronicity, science, culture, and psychonautics. Through the medium of open-minded dialogue, we explore the possibility that the only way out is in. www.thesyncbook.com/radio.
This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on Syncbook Radio. Today on episode number 4, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, former co-host of Always Record, Bill Klaus, as well as a trilogue with Dr. Donald DeGracia, author of Beyond the Physical and What is Science? While intended to release this episode weeks ago, fate as well as the holidays intervened. Regardless, I felt that both these guests have interesting things to say on authority, methodology, and process. So thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy.
Ask you right off the bat, B. Arthur.
Yeah.
How does B. Arthur come into the picture here?
It's funny you brought that. That had slipped my mind because bees have been entering my synchronicities lately, and beehives and honeycombs and that kind of thing. In the early parts of the book Ubik, they're talking about the precogs and how they see the future, and it's basically, they envision a honeycomb or a honeycomb grid, a hexagonal grid, or maybe it's pentagonal. I'm forgetting. I think it's hexagonal. Anyway, the hexagon that is most lit up is basically the most likely future. So anyway, that's a funny aside, I think. To answer your question though, it's rather pedestrian, and it's just, I used to play cards quite a bit online.
Okay.
And when you do that, you have an avatar. And I thought, well, what would be an ironic avatar? And so B. Arthur entered my mind. But at the same time, that must have been some kind of premonition, because now B. Arthur and B has some relevance to me, although Arthur still has no relevance.
Well, this kind of jogs a couple of things for me real quick. One is someone who's real near and dear to me, a cousin of mine. She was really tall, and she had three other sisters. And they used to make fun of her because she was the tallest and call her what was B. Arthur's name on Golden Girls?
I think it was Dorothy.
Dorothy. So they would make fun of her that she was Dorothy or B. Arthur just in general. And this cousin of mine, I don't know, she died about 7 years ago in a really tragic way. And it's impossible. It was impossible back then, but it's even more impossible now that whenever I see B. Arthur, I immediately think of this cousin of mine. And it's definitely a comforting feeling. So I don't know. It's just, that's why I had to ask. It's kind of like she's with us right now in some way in spirit. The other thing is that I didn't know you used to play cards online. You talking about online poker?
Yeah, mostly.
Yeah, man, I played a lot too.
I was okay. I wasn't bad. I was winning. And I don't know if over the long term, that's all you can hope to be. You shouldn't hope to be some kind of superstar or something. It's really not, that's not what it's about at all. Honestly, in a lot of ways, it helped condition my thinking for dealing even with stuff like synchronicity, because it's so much is about dealing with like variance in the short term and how to interpret fluctuations in results and how not to be results oriented. And it's about walking the path and not the destination. Well, it's in a way, it's about a destination, but that's a long-term perspective you have to take, and you have to be able to go with the flow and kind of deal with the ups and downs in the interim. And that's what it taught me. And that's what, yeah, I can't do it anymore because honestly, in the States, it's outlawed, quite frankly, except for a very few shitty sites that you can play on and not make money on. That's what it's become. And I'm still, I guess, a little bitter about that, but that's the state of things. And I keep that with me, that it helped foster a certain way of approaching problems and thinking and analytical thinking.
There's a very key word in playing poker. It's the word read, right? It's what's your read on the situation. And I think that's kind of that word or that action is at the core of what I think I'm kind of obsessed about, is this sort of ability that we humans either have convinced ourselves we're able to do, or it really is just an amazing collection of coincidences that, you know, we're able to read things. It's such an insane abstract concept, especially when you get into the world of poker. I mean, there are those magical, magical moments, and it's amazing that it can happen online, because it's so much more, I think, appealing when you do it in person. But when you're able to get a read on someone and know for a fact and feel it, and then get the payoff that you were correct by just taking all the information that's available to you and condensing it into a yes or no decision or a raise or fold decision. And just that ability, honing that ability and being able to put seemingly something very alive on the line. For what it's worth, I don't care. I mean, I've never had a lot of money to gamble with, but the adrenaline is always there in key hands, and you feel very, very alive in the moment as you wrestle with all that information in a very quick amount of time, and then actually sort of predict the outcome of the future. It's a thrilling, thrilling ability. I imagine you can relate to that on some level.
Well, you have those like eureka kind of like really intense moments where, yeah, you put in a good read or you see the pattern unfolding and you make the right decision, whether it's raise or fold, whether you lose the hand or not. Say you fold. I mean, that's still the right decision. So you can still kind of like ship it in and, or just, you know, back away from the situation. It's like, oh, well, a lot of folks that play the game though, their ego gets attached and they don't walk away from bad situations, or, you know, that's also a part of it as well. So it's the little decisions in between those kind of like big ones too. It's like, hey, have I made all these little decisions up to the big one correctly, or at least in a way that I can be comfortable with, knowing that, okay, say I'm losing over these 2,000 hands or something, am I making good decisions or not? Because it doesn't matter if you're losing or not. It really doesn't. It matters, are you being an idiot and losing because you're making poor choices, or at least you're not reading the information coming into you properly. So in the same way, synchronicity is similar, I'd say, because isn't the joke, well, okay, I saw an infomercial run twice in a row, so I should go buy that car or buy that piece of shit insurance policy or something, you know? That's inverted. That's not like what synchronicity is. So in the same way, like people can kind of go errant on that path, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's like if you've ever folded aces before in any situation where it just seems like the silliest thing to do, but you know that it's the right thing to do. And I think that definitely is more in tournament poker, which is a fascinating thing about poker, is that there are two worlds to the game, and they do take on different personalities. You definitely have to tweak your skill set in those situations, in a cash game as opposed to a tournament situation. And I definitely would, especially with online, because of the ease of and how often you could get into tournaments, I would go from cash game to tournament depending on where I was at. I felt like I was straddling two different worlds. And I'm grateful for that because I don't know how to define tournament poker as opposed to cash play, but you know, there is a eschatological immediacy of tournament poker that you have to be aware of, and that there are phases where you have to take actions that you normally would never take in a cash game because the structure demands that.
Right. In one situation, you could say have queens and you fold your queens, but in a tournament, you only have say 10 chips or something. You have to just go. It doesn't even matter what
you've got ace three and
yeah. You know, or in that situation, exactly. So you kind of like, you have to go with the flow, especially in tournaments, cash games, you can kind of stick to a strict kind of rigid formula. Whereas it still requires big reads and all that kind of stuff. But at the lower levels, you can kind of just beat people with a system almost. And then tournaments, it is more about adjusting. That's mostly what I've played. I'm not a cash game player. I'm a tournament player. And it's fun to win them. I mean, it's really fun. And I don't know. It's so funny we're having this conversation because I remember writing a really rudimentary essay maybe 4, 5, 6 years ago equating poker with life. And it's like, how can you draw parallels between this process, how you go through decisions, and also how that equates to life and like results and so on and so forth. And it's all this foreshadowing, right, to being kind of like involved with synchronicity. So that's very fun for me. And yeah, so much about synchronicity is this. And it's like, yeah, we're kind of getting into the nuts and bolts of say like poker, right? But I want to tie it back to just kind of like the bigger picture. And so I see poker and cards as kind of a bigger picture thing, as part of a bigger picture. And I really do enjoy also the occult aspect of it, where cards, you know, are basically descended from the tarot, and the tarot is descended from probably Egyptian mystery schools, and that goes back and back and back and back. So in this way, I've been playing cards, right? And now I've been playing cards in the past when I really wasn't well versed in archetypes, and I'm still not, or anything about tarot, and I'm still not, but I'm better than I was. But in the meantime, leading up to that point, I was still like kind of playing with it in an unconscious, subconscious kind of way.
I was able to make it to the casino for the first time in like 2 years, about 2 months ago. And I hadn't played cards in over a year. And I think that when you get deep into poker, you are always playing poker in your head to some extent, because the skill sets that you acquire, you realize they're just valuable skill sets. It's a good way to process information. And the freshness and the clarity of decision making that I discovered when I sat down at the table after this break was a feeling of invincibility, because it wasn't that I was going to win, but it was that I was making the best decisions possible with the chips that I had at my disposal. So every bet and every move, there just was an incredibly satisfying feeling of power behind the decision making. And in about 40 minutes, I had nearly tripled the amount of money or the amount of chips that I had in front of me. And I ended up losing all that money back in two different hands in the next 10 minutes. But I walked out of that casino completely satisfied with every decision I made. So I walked out of the casino with zero money. I lost all my chips, but I was almost on as good of a high as I could be, just because I felt like I had navigated the chaos to the best of my ability. And that's what I think the bigger picture to all this is, right? Is we want to be making good decisions, and we want to be able to utilize as much information as possible in the construction of our decisions. And why we harp and why we focus on synchronicity, I think, is that we're not saying that you should live your life by synchronicity alone, but if you're not utilizing it, then you might as well be wearing a blindfold as you step into the future. And for us to put to convince, I mean, I don't know if we're in the business of convincing the unconvinced. And I know we're not in the business of convincing each other, but we are sort of putting our foot out there and saying that it's an essential component to, for lack of a better term, living correctly, right? I think that's fair, right?
Yes. And I would go as far as to say, yeah, I like your analogy going into the future with a blindfold. And we always do. There's always the uncertainty. Even if synchronicity or whatever unveils kind of a path for you, there's still, I mean, that's a destination point, but it's like, how do you get there? What's the consequence of that? You don't know. And that's, it's not giving you those answers. It's just kind of like showing you a direction that's probably the right way to go. At least percentages speaking, because okay, here's another thing that poker teaches you. It's like you can only live life by percentages and by chance. And it's about gauging percentages and likelihoods and return on investment in any decision. Small ones, big ones, everything in between, return on investment. And that's not necessarily a monetary thing as much as it is like a psychic energy and kind of thing in synchronicity. So absolutely, I completely agree with you.
You know, okay, return on investment and that whole angle. And for whatever reason, we're talking poker here, but I think when internet poker hit, because it was already right there on our laptops and in our living rooms, there was this immediate realization to the intellectual poker player that why can't I just turn this machine on an hour a day and at the end of the month be $1,000 richer?
Yeah.
And do this for the rest of my life. Because as far as just economics goes, just an hour here, an hour there, if I log 40 hours a month or however time it is, if I do this intelligently over the course of 15, 20 years, my return on investment should say that this game I play, which I still enjoy, should be lucrative to a varying degree. And that is a type of poker playing that I think was born with the internet revolution, in the sense that the idea of being a career poker player was such a fringe and such an elite leap of faith that without internet poker, I don't think you would have spent that much time playing cards.
No.
Right? Because to drive to the casino, to spend time at the casino, not only on internet do you see more hands per hour, you know, for you to see the amount of hands you play in a week online, you'd have to spend a month at a casino.
Yeah.
The internet completely revolutionized a certain style of poker playing and brought in a whole metric system or a whole new allegiance to percentages, kind of like how baseball has the whole new category of sabermetrics, you know, of a very dehumanized statistical categories that sort of eliminate any part of the personality or the, I don't know how you say it.
Well, the game has become like way more sophisticated over the last 15, 20 years, especially since 2001 or something. I mean, so let's just say the last 14, 15 years, it's become incredibly sophisticated compared to where it was. The acceleration of knowledge. I mean, just again, to put this in general terms, I mean, you put enough eyes and attention on something and enough people have an interest in it, it becomes very evolved very quickly. And I mean, poker now, it's very, yeah, it's very metric based. There's a numerical, mathematical kind of businessman type of approach that you have to take to it. There's a lot to it. And it's on top of just knowing how to play. It's also about knowing how to control your emotions, it's all this stuff about, again, personal development too, that yeah, there's a lot of individuation that goes along with the process too. So it really allowed a segment of people to explore that idea. And yeah, so I said I was bitter earlier. And so I think I have good reason to be, I have good reason to be bitter because it's a cool thing and it's a fruitful thing. And we have special interests, mostly larger casinos that basically bullied out offshores and stuff. And that's what we have. So we have political games being played with people's kind of, I would even say, livelihoods. And it's kind of like a quiet death for a lot of poker, but no one cares when the big sites get pushed off because no one understands what that means for thousands of people. That now what? What am I doing with all that time and energy put into that? So this is, I guess, kind of what I'm doing now with it, you know? And I'm okay with it. I'm okay, but it's a little annoying. But it's cool because it's fun. It is just fun to connect all these dots and do all this. And so I appreciate the conversation. This is not one I expected to have. But I guess maybe to kind of change gears just a little bit, because you mentioned this idea of authority.
Yeah.
These conversations go hand in hand too, but you know, I've been thinking on authority generally myself, and also who judges what synchronicity, who judges what science is, who judges what the intersection is, and even something like poker, what is it, what isn't it, and all these questions. So I like this idea of authority, and maybe we'll get into that a little bit.
Okay, so I think here's a perfect real-time example of authority. A gentleman named Jason Horsley he's been around. I've seen his name for years. I've actually conversed with him maybe about a year ago, a year and a half ago. He was writing a very interesting piece on Philip K. Dick, and the crux of his thesis was Philip K. Dick autistic, or at least where did he fit on the spectrum of autism? And Jason has identified himself as being diagnosed with a mild form of autism. And I thought it was a very brave and searching article. I didn't necessarily agree with everything that was said there, but it was bold, and I appreciated his digging into the subject matter from a personal and interesting way. And that's not to say that's all Jason has done. I mean, he's anyone who's been through this material has had to have read an article by him or seen his name spot checked somewhere along the line. So the name carries some weight, is what I would say to anyone who has spent the last 5 to 10 years kind of in these circles. And so when he kind of seemed to turn his lens to Kubrick, Stanley Kubrick, and the works of Stanley Kubrick, I think a lot of people kind of perked up because it felt like, okay, here's somebody with, and so this is where we come to definitions of authority, but at least his name resonated and it was someone that you knew and someone was turning their attention to. So there was sort of a curiosity as to just exactly how he would approach the depth of this subject matter. And I think there's a great interview with him on Always Record, your show with Alan and David. And he recently wrote a treatment, I think, of his first article regarding the subject matter. And to make a long story short, there's a lot of people out there who might have been following this. The content of his dissection seemed to pale in comparison with the assumed authority that one would expect in this situation. There seemed to be something missing from the discourse. And in that void in the content, what was left over was, I think, in my personal reading, was hesitate to even call it a backhanded compliment, but there seemed to be something dismissive and something, a rejection of what I think he considers a phenomenon, and maybe an empty phenomenon at that. And you can read his article and you can listen to the interview. But what I'm saying is what I think set his article up for a certain amount of failure, at least in my eyes, was the authority that he brought with him to the subject matter. It felt like he just didn't get it, or it felt like he had missed the mark. It felt like, oh shit, I expected more here. Because of the authority of the investigator. I think the only reason why I probably listened to the interview or read the article was because of his name and the weight that it carried. I think what's so frustrating about that is is that there are so many people doing amazing work in the subject of Stanley Kubrick who have no authority, who seemingly don't have a recognizable name, and that work seemingly goes unnoticed. So you have, to maybe tie this up, you have this whole thing going on, but it takes somebody like Rodney Asher, who has a career, an established career, definitely talented, very talented, and with his authority was able to make a documentary, Room 237. I think for a lot of people that the authority of a Hollywood documentary with the accolades from Cannes Film Festival and reviews and whatnot, that it's that authority that makes that the official story on Stanley Kubrick and the people into them. And okay, so I guess my debate is, I think what a lot of us in this community are doing is, how do we get authority? How do we get our viewpoints and our work to be considered with more authority, with more weight? And the debate is maybe it never will. And I'm absolutely fine with that. But I wonder how you feel about that.
I don't think you're right. I tend to kind of side with that where I don't think there is guarantees of anything. And so if we are talking about percentages, and I think if anyone gets involved with an artistic enterprise, and that's what synchronicity largely is, it's art and science meet for sure. But there's huge amounts of artistic investment into it. So if you're investing artistically, you must have some kind of impetus or some kind of inner drive to do that in the first place, right? And then as time goes on and you produce better and better stuff, you're like, okay, now feedback would be nice. And how am I getting feedback and what's coming back to me and this and that? And then you start analyzing yourself a bit more in comparison to others versus just what am I getting out of it on a personal level? And not saying you shouldn't, because as humans, we are herd animals and pack animals, and we always need and want and crave recognition from others. And that's normal and healthy and all that. And we all need that and want that and deserve that. But at the same time, it's like with my art, I don't even know who's listening to this show. I can't imagine many people, but I don't really like, I can't even think about it anymore. I really can't, because it's like, I don't even know what I'm trying to get out of this as much as it's just like, it feels right to do. And at the same time, I see other people that I don't necessarily agree with here and there, not necessarily in synchronicity, because I'm still kind of like, I'm not as invested in a lot of some of the past conversations because I'm newer and some of the longer lines and threads that have been going through the personalities and stories and how they've unfolded over the years. But, in the same way I see other people like getting attention, I'm like, well, you know, I feel like I have really better things to say on that subject, but they have a platform and they've gotten a lot of attention. That's cool. And it's like, hey, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what I deserve. I don't even know what this incarnation is in so many ways. So I don't know what I deserve or don't deserve or if synchronicity is part of destiny, it's like, I don't know what part this is playing. So is my part really to get all this attention and be this person and be this like attractor for attention? Maybe not. And that's fine. It's just like, I have enough people I know that have given me some good feedback that I'm like, you know, I'm satisfied with what I'm doing. And that gives me a pleasure.
Because it's a process.
Yeah.
Because I heard you say that there was I can't remember exactly what you said, but the two words that jumped out are art and science. And I think that there is a word that's missing from that equation, and there's probably three or four others. And I think it speaks to the name of your show. We all know about quantum entanglement, correct?
Indeed.
All right. Quantum entanglement, you know, two particles with the spin, they get separated, they change one and the other one, spooky action at a distance. Boom. So we've all been through that. It's the math is there and it's this quandary, right? And we can say that these two particles are entangled. Well, I think that's like that's drawing a square around two objects and getting to a mathematical formula and having this huge question mark just jump out at you. And you can just, if it resonates with you in the least, it should keep you up at least for one night of your life. But I don't think that just two particles are ever isolated so well that they just suffer just a single entanglement. And I had this one word one day that was pentanglement, the entanglement of five things, which is kind of how I view the senses in a human being. I don't know what that means necessarily, but I think it just speaks that in that moment when I was thinking of that, is just the complexity is like, we can distill entanglement into two particles in a universe and get this mathematical equation out. But really when we deal with this thing in real life, we're beyond something as complicated as pentanglement of five particles that are entangled together. So art and science, I think people use that as the de facto debate, especially in the situation that I had mentioned earlier with Jason's article about Kubrick. But there's this word called magic, right? And it's a word that right now is glossed over in very Hollywood and horror film and comic book kind of wrapping paper. But really, it's a very scholastic term. It's a very dry, boring, historical reality. It's probably filtered down to us and different, but what it's referring to is something very, very specific. I kind of liken it to poetry. You know, poetry is, yeah, they're out there, but it's not changing the world right now. But it's not because poetry is dead. It's because I think we've forgotten what poetry is. When you see something poetic, you know for a fact what it is. And magic is something that when it happens, when you wrestle with it, you know what it is. And I think that the magician, how do I tie that to the alchemist? I think an alchemist is a magician. Understanding what alchemy was 500 years ago is a magical act. To be able to get yourself in a framework to understand exactly what the impetus and the desire of the alchemist was. To be able to put yourself in that headspace and then to do it, to enact your own alchemy in this modern age when all the secrets of alchemy have, from a scientific standpoint, have already basically been solved. And I think it's a lens that I personally acquired, I think, from hours and hours and hours of reading and listening to smarter people than I and diving into it. Crowley obviously was the entrance, but I mean, he's like the Alan Moore comic book kind of entrance into it. It really appeals to the younger man with its sort of promises of power and strength and sort of otherworldly abilities. But what it really is when you kind of digest it and bring it to the surface is something as ordinary as art and science and something as real as art and science. But if you want to understand how synchronicity relates to our world, I don't know if you can do that without a thorough understanding of magic. Just like I don't think you could understand synchronicity if you had without a thorough understanding of art or science or any of those big sort of subject matters.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed how you've spoken about magic as a practice. And I think so many people are engaging in magic all the time. Only in their own ways and in their own unconscious ritualistic forms. I mean, let's go to the most direct example. You have magicians and people like mentalists, where there is a difference though. There's even nuance to this, right? A magician is not a mentalist and a mentalist is not a magician. I heard it described like this. People walk away from a magician not thinking that what they saw was real, except for people that are very naive. Whereas if you see a mentalist, I think the most popular and best known version is Darren Brown on Sci-Fi or something, where he basically convinces people to do all this crazy shit through misdirection. And also, I mean, it's almost like it's waking hypnosis and all kinds of things that they're doing to consciousness that is actually very interesting. And I don't even think they know it as much as, again, they're enacting a ritual and it's getting an effect. they couldn't tell you everything that's going on with human consciousness in those states. I guarantee you they couldn't. There's not a materialist on earth that could describe everything that's going on with even something like mentalism that at a glance is just, oh, it's just manipulating someone's mind. Well, yeah, but that's what magic has always been. And some people do it through symbols. Certain people do it through ritual. Certain people do it through a more rigorous practice, maybe kind of what you're touching on with the deeper, more academic sense of it. Like, I feel like whatever quote unquote magic I've enacted in my life, even though I don't exactly know what to ascribe to it. I mean, that's a perfect word, but in so many ways, it's like so still mysterious that I can't even label it. But magic and occultism is the closest to describing it and the closest to the experience. Yeah, there's something more to it. And, maybe you'd like to get into a little bit, maybe how you see it and what the most productive way to approach it is. And I know you've also spoken of like discovering psychedelic breadcrumbs almost in your waking reality, maybe how those things tie into each other, if at all.
Well, I think that why magic is so dangerous is that it deals with the ladder between localized consciousness and non-local consciousness, right? And I think that anything that is occult, the reason why it's so dangerous is because it is non-political. Because if the borderlines of your universe are local consciousness and non-local consciousness, then how could you ever identify as a Republican or a Democrat or a Tory or a Mexican or an Irishman? Because if those are your borderlines and you exist between your local waking consciousness and non-locality, well, then your home is everywhere. And your brothers and sisters are everyone. So the magician and the occultist, the reason why they're on the fringe, the reason why they're so dangerous is that they cannot be coddled into the game. They cannot be told to sacrifice any element of their magical practice or their investigations. They cannot be corrupted.
Well, because the game, the larger game is magical, right? And it is magic.
Right.
So it's almost like we have our own symbolic self-defense in our own plane with those things.
It's like saying, hey, Peyton, you know what we're going to need you to do? We're going to need you to get drunk tonight and crash your car and not be able to play in the Super Bowl, okay? You're on board, right, Peyton? It's like saying, you know, I don't know. It's insanity. So the only black magic is magic done for political purposes. It would be someone who reached a certain threshold and then decided to use the knowledge that they gained to the expense of the other half of themselves. You see, because if you are, once you get to a certain point on this path, to fight against any other force politically would be to just fight against another element of your own well-being. And it becomes to a certain point impossible. And I think that's why magicians and occultists fall so far off into the fringe, because they can't resolve their place on a chessboard when they're asked to be a piece, a pawn or a bishop or a knight or even a king or a queen. They can't choose one side of the board. You know, so that's what the whole point about, you know, when your favorite artist sells out. You go, oh shit, I was following a fool, or I was following a faker, or this one couldn't go that far. I think that's what's so intoxicating about Kubrick, is that nobody owned him. I think that's the proof of a guy like that, of why he is regarded as a Magoo of the 20th century, is that, and I always use this other reference, like the Grateful Dead. Have you ever heard a Grateful Dead song used to sell a car or sell a pair of shoes or be prominently featured in a movie? I can't think of any. When you put it all together and you start to broadcast a certain vibration into the universe as an occultist or as a magician, it is what it is. And it either extinguishes itself quickly or it gets brighter. You know what I mean? So I think that authority for the magician is an organic development. It just sort of happens. You know what I mean? It just attracts its own numbers and its own masses.
Well, I think we all respect the law of attraction one way or another. I couldn't tell you the exact mechanism, and I don't always like some of the conversations surrounding it because I think it just kind of gets out there to the point of being, wonder what the word is, not relevant. But at the same time, law of attraction, law of repulsion, it's electromagnetism for you. It's certain things aren't always going to gel with you. And it's like, we can't all speak the same language. We can't all be drawn to each other. And that's the thing. It's like, we're a pretty small community, you know, and it's like, we're asking for everyone's attention and it's like almost impossible to get, you know, but it's also cool being on the ground floor of something and really developing it in a way that other people aren't trying to, even in the same way that say academics like Jung developed it and Pauli worked on it. And those are all important works. And even people nowadays occasionally come out with something like Alan Combs or Paul Davies, or there have been other good, pretty decent works. Oh, F. David Peet. But then there's this community that's kind of taking a whole other spin on it and is really accepting it. It's this accepting it as a reality that I'm most interested in. And Kubrick is a really interesting part of the story, like no doubt. And like you said, no one owns him. And that's an interesting way of putting it. I think that's the right way with all great art that resonates with so many people. There's no way it can just be saying one thing if it means so much to so many people, because it's so much about perception. And we just talked about this on Always Record 105. Alan said, you know, I think that sometimes these movies are the perfect scientific experiment because they're objective, right? And I said, well, yeah, in one way, but another way, we don't know. We don't know how consciousness works at all. We kind of do, but we kind of really don't. And so saying too much about it is kind of, or being too hell-bent or too dogmatic about what it is or isn't, you know, it's kind of early in the game. Even though I have my own ideas, I'm dogmatic, but I also try to relax that dogmatism when engaging with other people, I guess.
You relax the dogmatism, like, your own personal, or?
Yeah, my own personal. Because say my interpretation of quantum physics, right? Like my preferred interpretation is the Bohmian quantum potential interpretation, where it's the pilot wave is guiding all of the electrons and it's taking in all this information and it's processing its environment like an organic thing. That makes the most sense to me based on my world and what I've seen and how I view it. It's an organic view of microphysics. Now, the other interpretation is, say, something like you are creating the entire interference pattern. You're creating the collapse of the wave function at every moment. The Bohmian model doesn't have that, but this collapse of the wave function does, and there's some evidence for it. There's some evidence that your consciousness is influencing that wave function in a way we don't know. There's an interactionism going on we don't know. So we don't know if it's the consciousness is acting on it or what consciousness is the world consciousness. So do you get what I'm saying? Like, I can't answer that question, what is or is not. So I'm still preferential towards one interpretation. So that's my dogmatism. And I could still, and I still argue that with people like on message boards pointlessly, but I do it. And, and do you get what I'm saying? Like, but in this, yeah, in a real face-to-face conversation with someone, if they brought that up, it's not going to be like, oh yeah, I'm going to argue with you. It's like, why? That's a perfectly logical argument to make. As long as you're not trying to like make me choke on it, I'm not going to make you choke on mine, basically.
I mean,
I hope that makes some sense.
No, it does. I just, my mind flashed back to poker, because that's what's so great about poker is that you can enforce your own dogmatism and either get slapped in the face by it or reap the rewards.
Kind of, but kind of not, because your dogma could be, I'm going to be infinitely adaptable. And that's my ideal. That's not always the case, but I think poker, you can be. It's like, you're always trying to make the best decision based on the situation. Every situation is different. I mean, if you have like, say, top pair, I mean, that follows a similar trajectory, but there's always small decisions that are different, and there's different ebbs and flows and chip counts and all kinds of factors. It makes you weigh all the factors. That's the beauty of poker. So everyone, I mean, it should be taught in schools. That's how highly I think of the principles it teaches you as a human being. And it's absolutely ridiculous, the state it's in. But anyway, of course it descended from occultism. I'm not even into a lot of occultism. I'm really not. I'm kind of like a fool in that I just kind of stumble around and I I'm able to make a certain amount of like synchronicity in my life, but I don't really know what I don't have a practice as much as I produce stuff and I do these interviews and I think a lot and I think a lot and a lot and a lot and I think more and I read and I think that's my process. So if you're, I guess I do that more than most people. So I guess that's how I do my magic. That's as far as my ritual goes. I'm not as conscious with it, but I like seeing people that approach it in a way of, like you say, set and setting, which is a McKenna term. And I've always liked your take on McKenna and how you speak of him. And, you know, I don't like to make any patron saints. I'm not trying to make a patron saint of McKenna. I speak highly of him. But like I say, there's flaws with him, but wisdom is wisdom. I always say, like, even if Hitler says 2 + 2 = 4, it's like, I'm not going to say Hitler's wrong. I still think he's a dick, but McKenna's got so much good information on how to approach, I think, an altered states of consciousness, whether it be psychedelic induced plants or otherwise. I think there's so much overlap between these experiences that you can learn a lot from everybody.
Yeah. I think that goes back to occultism, is that an occultist could look at, you know, Adolf Hitler. Fuck, man. That whole fucking thing, man.
Just let it go.
Just let it go. But an occultist could say, hey, you know, the guy was a vegetarian. That's cool. Like vegetarianism is not crossed off the list because Adolf Hitler was a vegetarian. It's a very simple thing to say. No one should ever accuse you of supporting Nazism or any of that. But if you just were like, well, he got that right. I mean, an occultist mind can process that and not jump on someone for even suspecting that was just an inroad to them supporting the Nazi agenda, because it's just the most disturbed thing. So end of story there. And with McKenna, you know, just a dude who just, there was no internet. My God, if there was an internet.
Well, he was doing a pirate radio broadcast for a number of years. And that's kind of how he got his start and how he got a lot of attention. But
oh, really? I didn't know that.
Maybe I'm misremembering. I don't know. But anyway, go on.
I think this whole idea of a cult being non-political to me is such a breakthrough for me, because it takes the, what do I say?
It's not extremist. I don't see magic as extremist.
Yeah,
or politics as extremist.
But Kenneth says the world is made of language, and that's,
yeah,
that's such a beautiful koan to meditate over for years and years and years. And when you just realize that language created magic, created religion, created science, that these are just different parts of one big beast. And if you can see it that way, then you can relate to history better. You can relate to your present better, and you can make better decisions moving forward into the future. That's really all it is. You want to destroy certain firewalls that politics and religion and your own culture have put up in your brain that don't allow thought structures to travel across. The more connections you make, the richer ideas you have, the better decisions you make. It's really as simple as that.
Neuroplasticity, I don't know if you've heard that word, but if you focus your brain enough on a certain thing or topic or whatever, your brain is going to acquire such a unique imprint, and you're going to process information in such a unique way that, again, it almost doesn't matter the way you get there, because the way you get there is what makes you unique. It literally is like, that's what's so awesome about study. It's like, I know it's never for nothing, because I know even if I'm reading this and it's just either entering my unconscious or subconscious or whatever that is, I mean, there's some kind of imprinting process, and I'm improving. What is this? It's an inner development process. That's what alchemy has always been about. And this idea of, okay, yeah, they were brought in to turn lead to gold. Yeah, maybe some of them were. Maybe they were desperate enough to try to con someone they could do that. But inner alchemy has always been the process of the alchemist. That is what transformation has been, transmutation. It's energies. It's these emotions. It's these psychologies. And even just as an aside, something with cold fusion actually shows that transmutation at room temperature isn't so such a crazy idea, even though it's not quite harnessable in the way we think it is. But that even happens. So magic fucking happens everywhere, every day. And again, I just feel surrounded by symbols and messaging, and that is altering consciousness. And my question is, what, again, like, we can never know what it's like not to have those things in our mind, and with the effect of like congesting effect that has on either tapping into some kind of new layer of reality, this implicate order, whatever. I think synchronicity and all kinds of altered states or psychedelic experience, it's part of getting in touch with that and realizing, yeah, that nature is language. We're all language. Philip Dick was totally on the ball when he says that all we are information coils, taking in information, hopefully refining it, and then spitting it back out again. Because I don't think we're machines, and I don't want to say, oh, we just live in a big fucking computer that's just chugging along for no reason, because we're not. But that's an aspect of it. I mean, we are contributors to something much larger than we can never, ever know. And maybe we will know someday, but I don't know. But that's part of my process. I just see myself as part of something larger. And I'm not even I'm definitely not a religious person, but
did you ever have a religious phase?
Well, I was, no. I mean, I was brought up Catholic, but I just jumped through the hoops. Yeah, Irish Catholic. So I have all the guilt associated with that nonsense, but
man, I have to say I'm getting older and crustier, and I have, you know, a couple of nieces, and I see how kids act, and I see the chaos of their emotional inner lives. And I see something in what we refer to as Irish Catholicism. It seems like such a 1-2 punch to the gut. But there's a discipline in there. There's something, there is some truth in there. I mean, it has gone off the rails for sure. But there is a beauty and a simplicity to it. I'll paint this real quick picture. It's a beautiful little thing. So, that movie Exodus comes out, right? Exodus, Gods and Slaves, Christian Bale. I mean, Christian Bale. They've got a guy named Christian playing Moses. I mean,
yeah,
it's fucking beautiful. Anyways, you know, it's a turd, right? It's just a big CGI turd. They flung up on the theater right before Christmas because they know it's going to make a ton of dough. Or at least that's the thing, right? So I go, well, I'm gonna go see a movie, and you know, my whole thing, I like to select an album and smoke a little dope and go to the theater and listen to an album and just see the picture book. I just want to see how the director is telling the story as if it's a picture book, you know? And then and obviously with Exodus, I know the story, right? So I can just fill in the blanks and just see how the story is being told today, right? So I went through this crazy, I mean, I meditated upon what music I was going to play for about an hour and a half. And again, I'm getting these technical difficulties on my computer, and it forced me into one or two decisions. And I was like, I'll make the decision when I get there. And I get to the movie theater, and I always have this moment when I'm outside of the actual movie theater in my car, and I go, this is absolutely insane. There's no rational human being going through this behavior. You should be doing more with your life. And then I get over it, and I make my way in. And usually it takes about, you know, a couple of minutes, 5 minutes for the pot to kick in. And I try to hustle my way through public into my seat so I can feel a little bit more comfortable. And as I'm making my way into the theater, I'm expecting, you know, at a 12:30 Tuesday matinee that there's going to be nobody in this movie theater, right? And there's, you know, like 30 people sitting there in the seats. And in that moment, I'm thinking, this is a Bible story. Do these people know that this is a Bible story? And I go, are they Christian? Are they here because they're having a rough day and they just want to hear some of the good word? Or are they, what's the deal? Why, I know why I'm here. What are they doing here? And as I make my way up to my top seat in the back row of the theater where I feel comfortable, the idea that this story that's going to be presented to me is the same story that was told, you know, 100 years ago, 400 years ago. I mean, it's been told over and over and over. There's just these layers of hyper-dimensional resonance of the Exodus story, you know, of a people enslaved, led out of an empire and into you know, the wilderness to hopefully find their own land. And to make a long story short, I can sketch out for somebody this story of me going there and everything that went through my head and why I choose to do this. I can give them the formula, the album, when to push play, and such and such. And I can sketch out this alchemical formula of transformation of substance, which is, you know, a major Hollywood picture plus a studio album plus, well, the missing ingredient would be your knowledge of the actual story and whatnot. And all those things can be good and true. And people can kind of say, oh, I can see that. I can see how that works. And it's not for me, or that sounds boring. But the element of this whole formula that is confined to the crucible of actually doing the steps is beauty. Because there were moments of absolute jaw-dropping beauty in this formula that cannot, I can't think of a director, or I can't think of a painter, or I can't think of a musician who could construct those moments of absolute sheer jaw-dropping beauty that I experienced when certain scenes and certain songs coalesced into this one grand moment that stretches back over 2,000 years into history. And so I think with alchemy and with magic, and why I harp on authority, is how do I get people to just do this? Here's the recipe. Go follow these steps, do it, and tell me that you did not stumble into just absolute 400 foot pools of sheer jaw dropping beauty. Because it's that, it never fails to feel brand new. You know, it's like falling in love or missing a dead relative or whatever, that when the moment hits, it consumes everything around you and you could just die right there in the center of it and all of this shit would go away. It's just a very restorative exercise. And I think it's borderline technology at this point that should just be used. And I think people use it to a certain extent in fragmented and broken up microscopic ways. But if you can put it all together in this certain way, I mean, certainly this is not something I invented. You know, this is something that I heard about and was intrigued enough to try it and then refined my own technique. But just beauty like that. Awesome, mind-boggling, moment-transcending beauty. In a simple five-step recipe. I mean, I can't take your hand and I can't do it for you. And I've talked to David about this. I'm not a big fan of putting the sinks online for somebody to just click a button and then see it. Cause I think the work is one of the ingredients, because the work, brings in the doubt, and it's the doubt that gets eroded in the experience that creates, it's like the kindling for the beauty, in my opinion. But I certainly don't have the authority to get, you know, 100,000 adults to go smoke a hitter and put on some headphones and go see Exodus. And the album in question is, To Be Kind by Swans. They're just, Michael Gira is just, God, he's the Magoo of our fucking generation right now. He's, God, Michael, if you're listening to this, I love you, man. I'll see you in February. But I think that brings it all back to authority, is that there is a magic that we have access to for little money and for such simplicity, and it will open up these vistas of psyche transforming beauty that I just feel like everyone should be tapping into. It's worth it, man. And the more doubt you bring into it, it's just the more payoff that you're going to get. Yeah. So
I completely agree.